This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The Taliban has overrun a district in Afghanistan's province and reportedly captured dozens of government soldiers. Sunday's fighting comes as the United Nations warned attacks against aid workers in the country this year have increased by 20%. The governor would not discuss the fate of government forces, but local media reported around 100 Afghan security personnel are missing. A Taliban spokesman claimed its fighters entered the district without facing any resistance from government forces or causing any bloodshed. U.S. President Donald Trump Sunday angrily denounced the federal probe of Russia's 2016 election meddling as McCarthyism at its worst, insisting he had authorized his White House counsel to testify to bring the matter to a close. Mr. Trump's Twitter storm was set off by a front-page report in the New York Times that said the White House counsel had provided special counsel Robert Mueller with an unusually detailed account of Mr. Trump's thinking during key episodes under investigation. Meanwhile, the fallout from the president's revocation of security clearances continued Sunday, with former CIA Director John Brennan saying on NBC's Meet the Press that he's willing to give up a security clearance to prevent it from happening to others.
I will fight to keep their profession pure, objective, and not being politicized. And members of Congress need to step up. This is the time that your country is going to rely on you, not to do what is best for your party, but do what is best for the country.
Trump revoked his clearance last week. The death toll of Genoa's bridge collapse has risen to 43 as rescuers confirm the found remains believed to be that of a missing family. Firefighters discovered the three bodies, reported to be those of a couple and their 9-year-old daughter, early Sunday. They were inside a car extracted from the rubble, or rubble, of the viaduct. This is VOA News. Thousands of stranded people were waiting to be rescued, and officials pleaded for more help from relentless monsoon floods that have partially submerged the South Indian state of Kerala, where more than 190 have died in a little more than a week. More than 300,000 people have taken to shelters, and authorities say that they were being inundated with calls for assistance. A fresh tremor of 6.3 magnitude struck the Indonesian holiday island of Lombok. The U.S. Geological Survey said Sunday, this after an earthquake killed more than 430 people there earlier. David Doyle reports.
Indonesia's disaster mitigation agency said on Sunday that Rinjani was closed and there were no tourists there. Authorities last week put the death toll from an August 5th earthquake at more than 430 and said the island had suffered damage running to more than $342 million. After that quake, more than 350,000 people fled their homes to stay in government-provided tents or makeshift shelters in open fields.
With the Democratic Republic of Congo facing its second major Ebola outbreak this year, emergency responders have worked to contain the spread of the disease, and scientists are testing experimental vaccines in the field. Meantime, World Health Organization spokesman Tariq Jasarevich says more cases of Ebola are expected to be seen in the coming days and weeks.
It will get worse before it gets better. We don't know if we are having all transmission chains identified. We expect to see more cases as a result of earlier infections, and these infections are developing into illness.
Researchers in the DRC are collecting data that will improve how to prevent future outbreaks of Ebola and other infectious diseases. The annual Hajj pilgrimage begins today as over 2 million Muslims and faithful gather in Saudi Arabia. The pilgrimage represents one of the five pillars of Islam. It is required of all able-bodied Muslims once in their lifetime. In recent weeks, the faithful have arrived in Mecca from across the world. The Hajj offers pilgrims an opportunity to feel closer to God. This is amid the Muslim world's many challenges. Those include the threat of extremists in the Mideast after the Islamic State group was beaten back in Iraq and Syria, and a plight of Myanmar's Muslim Rohingya minority. And again, the Taliban has overrun a district in Afghanistan's northern Faryab province and reportedly captured dozens of government soldiers. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
We are committed to rebuilding this nation, and therefore, education is going to be key. It's going to be the basis, it's going to be the cornerstone in this rebuilding effort.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio plans to launch his free education policy on Monday.
A certain sense of anxiety hangs around because it is not clear whether the court is deliberating over the validity of the petition or the content of the petition.
The Zimbabwean Constitutional Court will hear the opposition legal challenge of President Emmerson Mnangagwa's recent election victory this week.
It is being said that vehicles are being bought for the Chief Justice to the tune of 1.2 million. And we are saying that is absolutely unnecessary. Yet the public servants cannot get their pay. This cannot be.
Civil society groups say the ongoing financial crisis the Kingdom of Eswatini is experiencing is self-inflicting. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Sierra Leonean president will officially launch his free education policy in the capital of Freetown Monday. Information Minister Mohamed Radu Soare says the free education policy forms part of the key promises the president made in the run-up to the recent elections. The implementation of the policy, the information minister says, aims to help all Sierra Leoneans educate their children irrespective of their social class or status. For more about the free education launch, I reach Information Minister Mohamed Radu Soare in Freetown.
His Excellency President Bio is officially launching the free quality education program tomorrow. This is a major flagship program of his administration. During the campaign, he did not miss an opportunity to remind Sierra Leoneans that if you want to destroy a nation, you do not need fighter jets to do that. You only have to preside over the collapse of its educational system. So for us, we are committed to rebuilding this nation, and therefore, education is going to be key. It's going to be the basis. It's going to be the cornerstone in this rebuilding effort.
People have expressed concern that sometimes when things are free, the quality becomes suspect. How will the president, or for that matter, his government, ensure that policies are implemented to ensure that the quality is sustained?
A lot of efforts are already in place. A lot of building blocks have already been laid. The Teaching Service Commission, which is supposed to regulate the recruitment, training, employment, and every facet of the employment of teachers, is now fully operational, fully functional, right? We understand there was no curriculum in the Ministry of Curriculum Department, in the Ministry of Education. That has now been fully constituted. And there is a quality control department. Inspectors of schools have been employed all around the country. Consultations are being held with civil society groups, conference of principals of secondary schools, community teachers associations, civil society groups to ensure that there are no compromises when it comes to quality. You know, the Minister of Education has missed no opportunity to mention that we will not tolerate anybody who tries to compromise the issues around quality. So, yes, we have made commitments going with the teaching. We believe we have to address issues of motivation, issues of teachers' commitment. So, His Excellency President Bio has committed to setting up a presidential commission on teachers' motivation. So that will be part of the processes set in place. And over and above all, the dependents of people who have taught for more than 10 years will now get free university education. You know, I was also a teacher. I wish I were still a teacher so that I could have benefited from that. Many teachers I have spoken to around the country are very enthused. They are very enthusiastic, and they look forward to the commencement of the free quality education.
President Maada Bio expressed concern the country was broke. So if the country has been broke for quite some time now, where is he going to find the money to fund this free education program of his?
Well, President Bio has said times without number, and it is a fact that we inherited the worst economy in living memory. But we, where there's a will, there is a way. We have put in place very rigorous and scrutinous processes. We have blocked leakages. We have, for the first time in the history of our country, allocated 21% of the national budget
to education, which surpasses all others. It even surpasses the education for all targets of 20%. So, yes, we have increased domestic revenue mobilization to fund free education. We have blocked leakages, you know, and government is very modest in our expenditures just to ensure that we support the free education. And over and above all, our development partners are very, very encouraged by the giant strides taken by the 120 this old baby to an extent that they have all come around to lend their support in various spheres. We have UNICEF, World Food Programme, and all UN agencies and other partners in country working with us to ensure that free education is a huge success.
How sustainable will this free education policy be? Because subsequent governments could be faced with finding the money to support this measure.
Well, the good news is, once we open the eyes of Sierra Leonean, the fact that this is a constitutional provision that Sierra Leonean should have access to education, they will not sit by to see succeeding governments in future eroding this opportunity, because we believe it's the right and proper thing to do. And I want to use this opportunity to challenge future governments, even after President Bio would have run for a second successful term, to ensure that free education remains key in the national development agenda, right? And it's a constitutional requirement already, so nobody can toil around it.
Mohamed Radu Soare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. The Zimbabwean Constitutional Court plans to hear the legal challenge of President Emmerson Mnangagwa's recent election victory on August 22nd. The Zimbabwean Electoral Commission declared Mnangagwa winner of the election with 50.8% of the vote, defeating Nelson Chamisa from the main opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, or MDC, who garnered 44.3%. But Chamisa rejected the results, citing voter irregularities and rigging. Judges at the court would have 14 days from August 10 to make a decision on the petition. For more, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
Well, there's so much buzz and excitement around, especially Harare. You know, it's expected, you know, social media is in overdrive and in the bus and buses, public transport, people are talking about this. But of course, a certain sense of anxiety hangs around, because it is not clear whether the court is deliberating over the validity of the petition or the content of the petition. Because, as you know, that ZANU-PF and the ZEC have been peddling around the narrative that the petition was late. But, of course, the MDC Alliance and opposition is insisting that the technical issue of the validity of the petition must be based on substance rather than on technicality.
What do you think of the possible evidence that the MDC Alliance would have? And do you think the evidence they have might have any impact at all on how the Constitutional Court will rule, particularly when it comes to the independence of the judiciary in Zimbabwe?
Well, there's a lot of explanations and analysis that have been put up onto the political market. And really, if you were an independent analyst, you would by now be totally confused. But of course, you know, my humble submission is that the both parties must have their day in court. The credibility of the alliance petition is based now on the sense that even ZEC itself, the Election Commission, have submitted that their numbers were flawed. So really, when you then look at the mathematical content of the petition, you can agree that they have a certain degree of relevance, and it's likely that the judges might look at it as credible. But whether or not the errors thereof are good enough to substantiate the demand for a rerun or a runoff is something that really nobody seems to know. But I can sense a strong amount of evidence that has been put across by the opposition.
What do you say to assessment by some analyst in Zimbabwe that if you look at the trouble that the military had to go through to force former President Robert Mugabe to resign for Emmerson Mnangagwa to take his place, it will be very naive to think that they will organize elections and then lose the elections and hand it over to the opposition. What do you make of this?
Well, it is a sensible argument, but then again, remember that Emmerson Mnangagwa is still hard pressed to show not just his integrity, but also the credibility of his mantra, Zimbabwe is open for business. He has done a lot of rounds in the world talking about credibility and the desire for peace. And it would be foolhardy for him to allow himself again to be used or to be influenced by the military entity. But like I've already said before, that this man is in power today purely out of the benevolence of General Chiwenga, because Chiwenga is the one who remained to hold the fort while Mnangagwa was in exile. So I do not completely dismiss that aspect, but I think for the purposes of Mnangagwa's integrity, he would want to minimize the influence of military even during a runoff.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Civil society and political pressure groups say the ongoing financial crisis the Kingdom of Eswatini is experiencing is self-inflicted. The groups say the government failed to manage the economy effectively despite a recent announcement that public sector workers will be paid. The financial crisis, they also said, has led to the shortage of drugs in state-run hospitals. This after members of the international community expressed concern about the kingdom's expenditure. For more about the concerns about the financial crisis, I reach Mario Masuku, chairman for the banned opposition party, PUDEMO.
PUDEMO has always said that the problem with the government of Swaziland or Eswatini continue to expand, their expenditure patterns are on the wrong side. This has been realized by the International Monetary Fund. However, currently, the king takes trips outside the country at enormous cost. Just yesterday, the news, it is being said that vehicles are being bought for the Chief Justice to the tune of 1.2 million. And we are saying that is absolutely unnecessary. Yet the public servants cannot get their pay. This cannot be.
But Mario, the government says it's putting measures in place to ensure that public sector workers are paid and that the country's financial troubles will be resolved. Isn't it the right measure to take to resolve the country's financial difficulties?
I was in the American celebration for their liberation a few months ago. The USA ambassador stated the worry by the international community about the expenditure patterns of the Swaziland government. Secondly, the European Union has also stated that they are now not going to support the free primary education program for Swaziland because of our expenditure patterns. Now, yes, the government has said now they will be able to pay the salaries of civil servants, but they have borrowed the money. Where has the money that has been paid by taxes gone to? Because what means they have borrowed the money from some conglomerates that will need to be repaid. That is not the kind of governance that we are looking for.
Well, but Mario, there's an upcoming election. The government has to organize those elections to ensure that the process of governance that involves the people is maintained. So why are these criticisms coming the government's way?
Firstly, these national so-called elections are not going to serve the people, because these people that are to be selected will go to a parliament that is not people-centered. Parliament that is controlled by the king, where the prime minister is not elected by the people. It is a non-democratic, non-accountable government. So we are saying, let us have a government that is people-centered, elected by the people, accountable to the people, that we can call to account.
Mario, there were issues of nurses in the government hospital who have been complaining about the lack of drugs. The government has said it is working on it to provide those drugs to the people who need them. Isn't this enough? Because some people are saying all you do is to criticize without coming up with tangible solutions to help with addressing some of these challenges.
You see, people must look issues from a broader perspective. You know, the USA government donate medication and funds through the PEPFAR, and a lot of people make donations to us. I, for one, have been to the hospital. You know, I am diabetic and hypertensive, and I went there, and there was no medication. What should the people do who are not well, who go to hospital? When the king and the queen mother, when they are ill, they fly to Taiwan. You know, we cannot understand that. The government is also supported by doctors from South Korea, doctors from Taiwan. Where are the funds going to? We are saying in Swaziland, without a democratic dispensation, people will always be looked at as second or third class citizens.
Mario Masuku is the chairman for the banned opposition party, Podemo. He spoke with me from the Swatini capital, Mbabane. Malian's elected president Ibrahim Boubacar Keita for a second term as president. He won 67% of the votes against competitor Soumaila Cisse, who garnered nearly 33%. The elections took place amid efforts by the government and international forces to stabilize and rebuild the country, which has been battling terrorist and intercommunal violence for several years. From Washington, viewers William Eagle takes a look at some of the issues facing the government.
Mali has a full plate of issues to contend with, from the economy to reconciliation and social justice. A peace agreement signed 3 years ago brought an end to fighting between the government and armed groups in the north. The fighting and instability has throttled a once thriving tourism sector and driven away private investment. Despite the challenges, the economy grew around 5% a year during Keita's first term. But the benefits of that growth have not reached rural areas. Jonathan Sears is an assistant professor of international development studies at Menno Simons College in Winnipeg, Canada.
The economic gains will be and are concentrated. They're regionally concentrated. My sense also is that they're concentrated within, if not sort of a bureaucratic, you know, sort of government business class, you know, obviously connected to specific sectors in terms of export agriculture and the mining sector, energy, real estate, A. And then B, most Malians live in the south of the center, and so the gains really end up being concentrated in the opportunity areas that gather around Bamako, like Sikasso, like Kai in the west. There's a wide swath of people who aren't seeing those gains, who aren't seeing that growth.
Sears and other analysts say the public lacks confidence in the government's ability to provide security and improve living standards. Arthur Boutelis, a senior advisor with the International Peace Institute in New York, calls the problem a crisis between the governing class and the governed, the state and its citizens.
And I think that's the main challenge, overarching challenge, whether we're talking security, justice, basic services. The main challenge for the state and for the government and for the new president will be basically to try to restore some level of trust in the state. When I say restoring some level of trust, is basically demonstrating that the state can provide services to people.
Conditions on the ground make that goal difficult to meet. Some armed groups did not sign the 2015 peace accord, so fighting and insecurity continue in some parts of the country. Government forces have failed to prevent intercommunity clashes in the central region and provide the security essential for reconciliation and economic growth.
The problem is they haven't have been able to expand their presence and have actually, I think, faced setbacks. And therefore, the agents of the state, administrators, justice, and so on, have actually folded back to only the main urban centers and have abandoned some of the smaller localities where, population feel abandoned by the state. There's a national plan for the central Mali, right? And there's a support plan by the European Union as well for central Mali. The problem is, how do you implement those plans unless, you have effective security forces that are also accepted by the local populations?
Efforts to improve security are part of the 2015 accords. All sides agreed to demobilize, and the rebels agreed to give up their weapons, and some would join Mali's military. As an interim measure, they agreed to joint patrols with Mali government forces and some of the armed groups. Critics complain the government is dragging its feet. Officials blame the situation on continued violence by armed groups, a lack of cooperation by some separatist forces in the north, and by donors who have failed to live up to their pledges. Analysts also say, besides military issues, the government needs to tackle corruption and impunity. Richard Reeve is the official chief executive of the Oxford Research Group in London, an independent organization specializing in new approaches to security and peace building. He calls for reform of the formal court system, which he says has been corrupted by political and economic elites.
Now, retraining is a possibility, but that takes a while. Bringing in less formal, less traditional judicial actors is a possibility, working with the chiefs and traditional authorities to coordinate them with the statutory court system, or working with paralegals, who are much easier to train than lawyers, than judges, than magistrates.
Reeve says more needs to be done to promote reconciliation between ethnic and community groups in the country's troubled central region. For this, he suggests increased participation, especially for youth and women, who make up over 3/4 of the population. He says Malian society is hierarchical, and those at the top are often not open to working with people below them. But adding other voices could make government more responsive and effective, promote reconciliation, and reduce the appeal of armed groups. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Former United Nations Secretary General and Nobel Peace Laureate Kofi Annan has died after a short illness. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva that Annan passed away at the age of 80 in a hospital in Bern, Switzerland, with his wife and children by his side.
Tributes to Kofi Annan are pouring in with expressions of shock and profound sadness at news of his death. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has issued a statement calling Annan a good friend and mentor. He says Annan was a force for good whose legacy will remain a true inspiration for all. In a heartfelt statement, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad Al Hussein speaks personally of his close friendship with Annan and of the painful loss to the world of such a great leader. Zayed spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA the two men had a very strong relationship akin to that of a father and son. She says the High Commissioner considered Annan a mentor and would often seek his advice.
The High Commissioner would sometimes begin to doubt himself, whether he had gone too far in his robust advocacy for victims and his criticism of state for failing to address the human rights violations. And he would go to Kofi Annan, and invariably he would get what he wanted. Either it was endorsement, a sense of don't care what people think, you are doing the right thing, or strategic advice, constructive and frank advice about what he could do better.
After his retirement, Annan moved to Switzerland, where he created the Kofi Annan Foundation to further the cause of peace. He also was the chairman of an organization called the Elders, which was founded by Nelson Mandela to address global human rights issues and abuses. Annan, who was born in Ghana, never forgot his African roots. He felt a special responsibility toward Africa and worked tirelessly to further African development. In 2001, He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize jointly with the United Nations for his humanitarian work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Holders Wydad Casablanca of Morocco and Al Ahly of Egypt managed 1-0 victories on Friday to reach the African Champions League quarterfinals. Following Saturday's results, the three places in the last eight remain up for grabs with one group game to play. Wydad and Ahle joined DR Congo's TP Mazembe along with Tunisia's duo Etoile du Sahel and Esperance, who had already advanced to the last eight. The final fixtures in all four groups will be played on August 28th. In Group A, eight-time winners Al Ahle continued their Champions League dominance of Esperance in Tunisia thanks to a goal from Moroccan Walid Azaro. If Ahle beat KCCA in Egypt this month, they are guaranteed to win the group while seeking a record-extending ninth Champions League title. On Saturday, in a game with only pride at stake, KCCA of Uganda earned a 1-0 win over visiting Rollers thanks to Patrick Kadu's goal 7 minutes from time. The win means KCCA are third in the group with 6 points, leaving Roller bottom 3 points behind. TP Mazembe ensured they will finish top of Group B thanks to a 1-1 draw in Algeria against Entente Setif on Friday. The second quarterfinal spot from the group is now wide open with three teams on 5 points after Morocco's Difa Al Jadida beat visiting Malodia Algar 2-0 on Saturday. The final games on August 28th see Jadida travel to face Mazembe and Malodia hosting the Algerian derby with Setif. Two draws would see three teams on 6 points, with Jadida advancing thanks to a better goal difference in the games between the three sides. Reigning champions Wydad Casablanca were the first team from Group C to progress thanks to a 1-0 win over South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns on Friday. The win for Wydad, who beat Ahle 2-1 on aggregate in the 2017 final, also ensures they'll finish top of the group. The South African side must now defeat a second-placed Haroya at home in their final group game to finish runners-up on the head-to-head rule, having drawn 2-2 in Conakry during May. Haroya kept up their bid for a quarter-final place with a 2-1 win over Port of Togo on Friday. Meanwhile, Lazarus Kambole's 5-minute hat-trick saw Zesco United beat Mbabane Swallows. The second qualifying place for Group D will also go down to the final pool match with three teams still in contention to join Etoile du Sahel. The Tunisians are guaranteed to finish top of the group despite being held to a 1-1 draw by visitors Premio de Agosto of Angola on Saturday. Zambia Zesco kept up the pressure on Premiero with a 3-0 win in Eswatini over Mbabane Swallows. In the final group games, Zesco host Etoile at the same time as Swallows play in Angola against Premiero. In order to progress, the Zambians must win and hope Premiero do not collect maximum points. Swallows could still sneak in to the last eight with the win over Premiero coupled with a Zesco loss. In another development, Nigeria were knocked out of the Women's Under-20 World Cup in France by Spain on Thursday. The Nigerians had scrapped into the last eight thanks to a late goal that saw them draw 1-1 with China, that followed a 1-0 loss to Germany and a victory over Haiti by the same scoreline. Still in football, FIFA has issued ultimatums to Nigeria and Ghana that they both face bans from global football for undue influence in the affairs of their governing bodies. Nigeria's ban could begin on August 20th if the Nigerian Football Federation offices are not handed back to the legitimate executive committee under President Ahmadu Pennick. Meanwhile, FIFA says the government of Ghana has pledged to stop the process to dissolve the country's Football Federation, GFA, over corruption allegations. Earlier last week, football's world governing body gave Ghana until August 27th to withdraw a court case or face a global ban from football. A global ban would put Ghana's 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Kenya on September 8th in doubt, while Nigeria are due to travel to face Seychelles the same weekend. Senegal and Tunisia are the joint highest African nations in the latest FIFA World Rankings following their World Cup campaigns. Tunisia dropped 3 places, 24th in the world, after winning just one of their 3 group matches in Russia, while the Taranga Lions climbed 3 places to 24th globally after a win and a draw from their Group H campaign. Egypt are the biggest losers globally, dropping 20 places to 65th after 3 losses at the World Cup. The Faroes are now 11th on the continent. Morocco, who managed a draw and 2 losses in Russia, fell 5 places to 46th overall. Nigeria, Africa's other representative at the World Cup, lost just a single place after their 1 win and 2 defeats. World Cup winners France moved to the top of the global list, with Belgium in second spot after their 3rd place finish in Russia. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
When the going gets tough, the tough must get going.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Opposition becomes our position.
is a message to the government, expressing what's exactly on the people's mind. Uganda etambula eda mabiga kitu seno kutweta mye gwanga lya fe mulimba mutufuga bubinyo namwe kalite tuganye mwana na munsiko naye gomana gwe wasanga ngata nazali wakati naye yazala nata kino mukingambire muze yaba mutukako sabane baze ibane bamugambeko ene songa chamunyo jalemedeko kati egwanga lyona lyenyamide bagambe yalinga demokulase mamuvuluka kati yafuka na ipokurise bagambe yali fundamento chenji majizala wakati mujifunde no chenji bagamba chensongeza balwanya kati mazibuka kona mwe mukola biri ebyabali bakusaba nti constitution yawe tojikwata kukuba mwe musigade subi lyabwe I say we are fighting for freedom. Kampala mokotumba de jinja. We are fighting for freedom. Kabalelu kunjiri malala kasese. We are fighting for freedom. Soro tichitugum, aru walira gun. We are fighting for freedom. Aise wakiso masaka, wende mityana. We are fighting for freedom. Yo! We are living in a time similar to the one of slave trade. This operation is worse than apartheid. The gun is the master, citizen slave. The ball of Africa is bleeding. Question, what was the purpose of the liberation when we can't have a peaceful transition? What is the purpose of the constitution when the government disrespect the constitution? Where is my freedom of expression when you judge me because of my expression? Look what you're doing to this nation. What are you teaching the future generation? See our leaders become misleaders and see our mentors become tormentors. Freedom fighters become dictators. They look on the youth and say we are distractors. We are fighting for freedom. Bossy amalaba, motukola chotera. We are fighting for freedom. Ebi bakwa chimoro to chadundu. We are fighting for freedom. Adelma Cindy, Kabun Karamoja. We are fighting for freedom. Oi Machiri and Dongo, Foti Mundi Vujo. We are fighting for freedom. Tuke baboi, atuchi manyinti Okununule nkwanga chituka katako Fabana ba Uganda fena Era manyati botu nulire vichamu Nosirikire yo olide munsi yorukwe Na fea bakulwa nilakogwe Nosirikira jolio vero tusadase Tukira tinewe bubera bumyunga wakunganye Ngobu jitwala terinya No matter your age, no matter your sex No matter your religion, no matter your tribe Whether educated or uneducated It's a revelation for the generation. Whether you are a doctor or a farmer, whether you are a teacher or policeman, could I be a tax driver or a student? Could I be a lawyer? Could I be a soldier? We are fighting for freedom. Pussy to give a boy, temo po a boy. We are fighting for freedom. Bana Uganda, bali kumawanga. We are fighting for freedom. Abana baboda, boda namwe mwebiririmu. We are fighting for freedom. Yes, man, like Martin Luther said, in the end, we remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence. Our friends. Mugamba mukondera Ngaya mugamba ati yetakola byachikwangala Ngaya mugana ebyokurana Ngabo mukubetama akuchusiza dala Naya ukana nyo kubabubuka balala Ngaya mugana bawali nguli nenjaga
sange gani sanga yone kaneka Mamite ya chimanyanti yali ya chikwangala Pasta yali muyaye ngano nyaza mata Namo igirizo kusigano kugaba Ntiamu wesenta genda yamba wajagana Pasta kwa samu chitibwa Yafuka muya iye Nenja ikati ajinywa Ayokeraru ya iye Nemuchi ya ye jasula Ama muito muya iye Tebyechi ya ye vyakola Na yaba itaba ya iye Kubate wakola vyebabuli Yeno, ono chuka Kufuka tato mulunja tesita zavana Bakuyikire kovidi nyo Memu kama watu Agamba wana wange wa pasta vaya evanji Na yena watufu vanji nyo Inge ya simbe vinyewa Merela mwevi toto yo pasta kwe wasanga
Chingale, chino tu chingale, jira tu chingale, we, jira tu chingale, chino tu chingale, jira tu chingale, we.
You have been far away, ngomoti magulu maguluma, ngabuli rwene sunga watako, ngabiba biroto mwemba.
Lava what to say, not ever make a cool say. Makulama to know I know any mama. Mumuana Mudiana, Mitiawa Mitiova, then they may young one. Oh, Jem and then I see a lot.
Don't you worry.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Juna.
Good evening, Africa. Africa and the international community suffered a grievous loss when it was announced yesterday that Kofi Annan of Ghana, the seventh Secretary General of the United Nations, died. He came from Ghana, and he was the second Secretary General of the United Nations from Africa. Kofi Annan was a quiet, non-confrontational Secretary General. he succeeded Boutros Boutros-Ghali at a time when the secretariat was in turmoil. Boutros Boutros-Ghali, a superb scholar of international relations, could not embrace the mantra of the international community at the time. That is, that there was only one superpower, and that one must confine one's policy to meet that reality. Boutros-Ghali's fierce independence ran afoul of this mantra, and he was denied a second term. Kofi Annan succeeded him in 1997, and he provided a transition. As someone who had worked for many, many years in the secretariat in different forms, beginning with WHO in 1962, and then with the Economic Commission of Africa, and later on with the UN Secretariat, he tried to fashion the Secretariat in the spirit of the end of the Cold War. His reform proposals changed the workings and nature of the Secretariat in light of this mantra of one superpower. But the vagaries of real politics and the changing nature of international relations soon caught up with this mantra. And Kofi Annan was in the midst of that, particularly at the outbreak of the Iraq War. Throughout his life, he insisted that he was against the Iraq War, against Saddam Hussein. But his low profile did not allow him to articulate that at the beginning. But he later became a public enemy in the way of conservative forces in the United States, particularly the Republican administration of George Bush. And in the midst of this, there came the so-called scandal of oil for food. And this was used by conservatives to remove him from office. But in the end, he was exonerated as not having committed any crime. Kofi's Annan changing of the secretariats and the International Civil Service was not something embraced by veterans of the International Civil Service, but he believed fervently that that was the way to go. When he left the Secretary Generalship, he was succeeded by Ban Ki-moon. And it was not surprising that few years into Ban Ki-moon's reign, many in the Secretariat and the diplomatic community in the UN were yearning to see the return of Kofi Annan. Kofi Annan played many roles in Africa after he left the office. He mediated mainly in Kenya and helped that country to reach the transition after the election. Kofi Annan, in 2015, gave an interview to deal with the conflict of the Secretary General. When Boutros-Ghali was refused a second term, he was said to have failed to deal with the issue of his role. Those opposed to him said he acted more like a general than a secretary. Kofi Annan, in the end, given his wide experience, said, "Secretaries General should act both as general and as secretary. There are times when it requires a firm hand, and there are times when he has to compromise." This, to me, is the legacy of Kofi Annan, whom we all mourn, and may his soul rest in peace. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Patrick Deya, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who moves with each day is better than another who waits for luck. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo will hold an election in December, hopefully leading to a peaceful democratic transfer of power for the first time in the country's history. Sitting President Joseph Kabila came to power in 2001, having succeeded his father, Laurent Désiré Kabila, after his assassination. Joseph Kabila was elected president in 2006 for a five-year term and re-elected in 2011. Though his second term ended in 2016 and the DRC constitution prevents him from seeking a third term, elections were not held and Kabila remained in power. Following protests in September 2016, Kabila's ruling party and the opposition signed an agreement known as the Saint-Sylvestre Agreement on December 31, 2016. The agreement paved the way for elections, prohibited Kabila from running for re-election or changing the constitution, and committed the DRC government to a number of confidence-building measures intended to create the political space necessary for credible elections. In November 2017, DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission finally announced for December 23, 2018. Many feared President Kabila would nevertheless attempt to run for an illegal third term, but those fears were allayed on August 8, the deadline for registering presidential candidates, when the DRC government spokesman announced that Kabila would not seek re-election. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the ruling coalition's announcement of a consensus candidate, other than President Kabila, represents a significant step forward for Congolese democracy, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. We are encouraged by this sign that Kabila intends to uphold his commitments to the Congolese constitution and the terms of the December 2016 Saint-Sylvestre Agreement by not seeking a third term. Government, opposition, and civil society leaders, along with the heads of the security services, share with President Kabila the responsibility of ensuring full respect for democratic norms. The Congolese people must be free to express their views and choose from the candidates without fear of violence, threats, or intimidation. We call on DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission and Congolese authorities to take the necessary steps to guarantee credible elections on December 23, 2018, said Heather Nauert. The DRC has an historic opportunity to ensure a peaceful transfer of power in December, and the United States looks forward to supporting this process in accordance with the established electoral calendar.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.